part two of a webinar that I started last week called Reasonable Suspicion Deep Dive. And so we're going to continue the conversation, talk about a lot of cases, a lot of information coming at you. This is going to be really worth your time. A lot of people have questions on probable cause, and I hope to answer them today. For those who are watching on demand, please keep in mind that I have several hundred of your fellow officers from around the country here right now. That means that, you know, I can't see them. They can only see me. They can only hear me, but I can see what they type, right? So when they make comments and they make their jokes and they try to banter back and forth with each other and they try to hook up and meet new friends and maybe future spouses or ex-spouses. And I just look at it and see what they're going on. So if I have a question from there or some context to share with you from them, I will share it with you. But when I'm looking over there, you know, that's kind of what's going on here. So my name is Anthony Bandiero. I work for Blue to Gold full time. This is my dream job. I just love teaching officers. I am broadcasting from a lowly hotel room in Gainesville, Texas. Earlier this week, I was in McKinney teaching at Collin College, the police department there. Now I shot over about an hour north near the border of Oklahoma at Gainesville. I leave here. I go home for a day, just one day, and I go back to, I fly to Steamboat, Colorado. And then I'm also going to be going to San Antonio, Texas next week. And so Kansas, absolutely. I love Kansas. I love teaching there. So, it'll be a good time to meet my friends in Kansas. So that's who I am briefly. Guys, we have started something new. This is amazing. Who doesn't love guns? I know I love guns, right? I mean, I got a few guns with the serial number rubbed off just in case. We all want that just in case gun. So I'm going to give away a gun at the end of this webinar. Here is the rule though. Okay. The rule is that, it's only for police. Oh, ATF is here. I didn't mean to say that. I was just joking. It's only for police officers, retirees, military. We're throwing in the military just for some love, but we're looking for who our customers are and also prosecutors. So if you are a civilian that's just kind of watching this because you enjoy what we teach here, welcome. I'm glad that you're here, but the guns go to really our customers, which is, you know, mainly law enforcement and prosecutors. So we will announce that the person who wins does not have to be present. However, if you go and, you know, when you sign up for the webinar, you're automatically entered to win this firearm. And so defense attorneys are amazingly nice to me though. Mike, I don't know what it is. I think they appreciate me a little bit by making their job a little easier so that if the cops get it right, their job is actually a little easier. So, anyway, we're going to be giving away a firearm. What firearm we give away is a variable facts that I have in my brain. I kind of decide what I'm going to give away, right before the webinar. It'll be a surprise at the end. It all depends. Sometimes it's a pistol. It's a shotgun. It's a high point with a factory obliterated serial number, things like that. We'll talk about it. All right. Okay. So the books you guys got to, right? You guys got to get the books. The books are amazing. I'm not just saying that. They're written for you. I spent years and years and years perfecting these books. They're not perfect, but trying to perfect them. Verb meaning action. I am trying to make them always better. The search and seizure book is the only search and seizure book. I shouldn't say the only, but it's the most popular search and seizure book in America by far. And it's really one of the only ones that's written for you in mind. The Supreme Court book. The report writing book, the report writing books, the Bulletproof Report Writing, the RSPC Pocket Guide are off the hook. Guys, I do a lot of stuff for free, and I appreciate when you support Blue to Gold by going to our classes, by going online and watching our on demand, by buying our books. It really does help our mission here. You don't need to buy anything from us for me to give you my heart and soul, but it sure helps you, and it also helps us support our mission. So please check out the books. Okay, afterwards, we are going to do a search and seizure show. And let's see, I don't know if I have a co-host tonight, which is fine. But But the deal is, somebody asked me, "Hey, I'm new to Blue to Gold. I heard you guys, pretty much answer questions, how do I turn my mic?" Well, that happens during the show. If you want to ask a question, I can turn on your mic, and then you can hit accept, and you can ask your question. But for those who want to ask a question, please get that question lined up, and right after this webinar, we'll go to the Search and Seizure show, and I'll answer your questions live and give you some education on various search and seizure issues. You can't be a lawyer without giving disclaimers. Laws and your standard operating procedures may be more restrictive. If I teach you something that your state is like, "Nah, we actually do require something different," then so be it. If you have any doubts about the legality of your actions, push it up the chain. And finally, I am a lawyer, but I'm not your lawyer. So if I ever say anything in this class that your lawyer is like, "Well, I don't want to do that. I want to do this." Well, that's what you're paying them for. That's what you're paying them for, right? They get to make those legal decisions. All right, we have a lot to cover. Probable cause in general, defining probable cause. It's hard, but we're going to make a darn good attempt at doing it. We're going to talk about using your training experience and other things, and we'll kind of discuss the difference between probable cause and reasonable suspicion, factual justification continuum, burdens of proof. We're going to talk about source information, source credibility, the informer's privilege. Man, we have a lot to cover. Okay, so probable cause in general, right? Now, this is a very important point. There is no such thing as a probable cause only search or, right, probable cause only search or seizure. Okay. It doesn't exist. Okay. If you can tell me in this chat, if you can tell me a search or seizure that you do that only requires probable cause, I will give you $100 right now. Okay. If you can say, "Anthony, I have a search that I can do with only probable cause," I will give you $100. I will send you $100, in the mail, through PayPal, whatever. But the thing is, I'm not going to waste your time, and you don't have to waste mine. You can't come up with it. Okay. Because the reality is, actually, Michael probably got the closest. He says driving a Nissan Altima. That is reasonable suspicion, not probable cause. You are close, but you're not there yet. Okay. So it's every time you do a search or seizure, it's probable cause plus. It's probable cause plus motor vehicle. It's probable cause plus search incident to arrest. It's probable cause plus the private search doctrine, i.e., cat out of the bag. It's probable cause plus exigency. It's probable cause plus, plain view, right? Plain view seizure. Probable cause plus warrant. So the point is, you need something more than probable cause. And I got it, guys. It is true. Please write this down, okay? Please remember this. Please use this in your training. When you are assessing whether or not you or your peer, right, has lawful authority to do a search or seizure, you need to ask yourself, "Do I have crew?" Okay, Mark uses it with his recruits all the time. Absolutely, you need to use it. Because, by the way, I came up with the acronym, but I did not come up with the three things. Consent. Consent allows you to search or seize without a warrant. If you do not have consent, look for a recognized exception. There are all kinds of recognized exceptions. And if I had a book right now, my search and seizure book, I would just point out a lot of them, right? And it's the motor vehicle exception, it's hot pursuit, fresh pursuit, administrative searches, special needs searches, it's the border exception, it's workplace searches by government employees, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But if you do not have a recognized exception or consent, you better have a warrant. And one thing that I know, right, that Mark and my fellow officers here that use this are teaching is that CREW does not stand for can't really explain why. Those days are over. There is a dramatic, drastic, fundamental difference between an officer working in 1985 than 2025. The officer working in 1985, quite frankly, did a lot of searching and seizing with not a lot of articulation, and that will not work. Okay. So, as the court has said, probable cause is a flexible, common sense standard, merely requiring that the facts available to the officer would warrant a man or woman of reasonable caution to believe that certain items may be contraband or stolen property or useful as evidence of a crime. It does not demand any showing that such a belief be correct or more likely true than false, right? Now, there could be, absolutely, Corey says there could be a class, 40-hour class on recognized exceptions. Absolutely. It's called the search and seizure instructor, right? So the certified search and seizure instructor class that we do. That's a 40-hour class overall with all the training, and that's almost full of exceptions, right? So it's also been described as perhaps the central teaching of our decisions bearing on the probable cause standard is that it is a practical, non-technical conception. As the very name implies, we deal with probabilities. I actually love this quote because when you think of probable cause, you think, hey, is a crime probably occurring? Did this person probably commit this crime? We deal with probabilities, not technical, but factual and practical considerations of everyday life on which reasonable and prudent men, not legal technicians, act. When the Supreme Court says that we do not base, probable cause on what legal technicians think and how they act, who are they talking about? Who is a legal technician to the U.S. Supreme Court? State in the chat. Stinking lawyers. Okay. You guys don't stink. Okay. Lawyers. Stinking, greedy, bloodthirsty lawyers. I'm just kidding. Most lawyers are good, including defense attorneys, without a doubt. I mean that with all sincerity, right? But sometimes, unfortunately, they poo-poo things, right? They kind of are a little bit of a buzzkill because they try to overcomplicate things. Do you guys agree? Isn't that like the main issue with lawyers, as far as we're concerned, is that they sure love to overcomplicate simple things, right? Why? Because they get paid more money when they complicate things, right? They get more billable hours. So it's through your eyes, it's through the lens of a reasonable police officer with your experience, right? Now, sufficient probability, not certainty, is the touchstone of reasonableness under the Fourth Amendment. I actually sometimes hear, police officers talk like that. They're like, well, we're not certain that the evidence is in the car. We're not certain he has evidence on his person. And you got to remember that it's not certainty that that you need for probable cause. Of course, it's not certainty. It is fair probability, right? It's just based on the facts, is there a fair probability, not certainty. Now, trying to define probable cause is a little more tough, right? A little more tough. So, probable cause to arrest, a good overall definition is facts and circumstances drawn from a reasonably trustworthy source that would cause a reasonable person to believe that a particular individual has committed a crime. Now, I'm going to give you a little pro tip. When it comes to probable cause, right, the level of certainty, what requires more certainty? That a crime has been committed or that this particular person has committed it? When it comes to serious crimes, right, that a crime has been committed or this person, I will tell you, if you look at the case law, we need some pretty good, some solid probable cause, maybe call it clear probable cause if you want, that a crime has actually been committed, right? And then we just need a fair probability that this particular person has committed it. Because we don't, I guess the reason is that we don't want to take a person to jail when we're not even really sure a crime has even been committed. I think the courts care about that more, like as far as, hey, we're not saying we want to arrest innocent people. That's not my point. My point is, when it comes to serious crimes, we want a really good foundation that a crime has actually occurred, and then a fair probability that this person has actually committed the crime. Somebody's asking about this instructor class. So the instructor class is usually not online. Well, I'm sorry, I should say it's not on demand. And but we do have the search and seizure instructor class online. It's broadcasting from Colorado, so that'd be Mountain Time. And that's coming up when, Rick? Isn't that coming up like very, very soon, right? This week. Okay. So Arnie says, is the community caretaking search doctrine viable? Absolutely. And do me a favor, if you, I'll tell you what it is and what it's not. I know that somebody, my LT told me it has been changed. It has changed, but it's still a legitimate doctrine out there. And I will explain that. If you want, I'll explain it, how it applies outside the home, like Amanda is saying. So, probable cause of search, facts and circumstances drawn from a reasonably trustworthy source that would cause a reasonable person to believe evidence of a crime is located in a particular location. Now, did I say anything about you need probable cause that the suspect is in the house? No, right? What if the officer's belief is later disproven? So you thought you had probable cause, but you're later proven that you were wrong. Will you be liable for a bad search if you're later proven wrong? And if you don't find anything or the person was innocent and so forth? And the answer is no, right? As the US Supreme Court has said, because many situations which confront officers in the course of executing their duties are more or less ambiguous, room must be allowed for some mistakes on their part. These kind of like these quote unquote good faith mistakes. But the mistakes must be those of reasonable men, acting on facts leading sensibly to their conclusions of probability. We have a saying, at Blue to Gold, right? A golden rule that we do not work in a world of possibilities. We work in a world of what? Probabilities. Anything is possible, right? Is it possible that I have evidence of financial crime, on this phone? Absolutely. I pay taxes just like you. You know what I mean? So the point is, yes, it's possible, but you don't have enough to go get a warrant, right? So you, so I was watching, I don't know how this is, but I was watching a video last night about how all the super rich, they register their supercars in Montana because it's like you don't have to pay taxes on your supercars. And when you look at a Bugatti, which is a $1 million sports car, when you look at a Bugatti rolling around in LA and it has Montana plates on it, is there a probability that that registration is probably a hoax, right? Or fictitious? Not fictitious, it's fictitious, not the right word, but it's a game in the system, of course, right? So, and I don't blame him one bit for it. I wouldn't want to pay California taxes either. Terry accepts the risk that officers may stop innocent people. Ooh, so check this out, right? Not everybody, you could be wrong here. Indeed, the Fourth Amendment accepts that risk in connection with more drastic police action. Persons arrested and detained on probable cause to believe they have committed a crime may turn out to be innocent. In fact, it often does, but that's why we have a higher standard, which is beyond a reasonable doubt in court. Now, it is very important to recognize, as the very name implies, that probable cause leaves room for mistaken conclusions. As supervisors in this room, as chiefs in this room, right, we should understand that just because your officer is later proven wrong, that they did not have, that they got the wrong guy, but if they had probable cause at the time, they should not be penalized. They should not be disciplined as long as they were reasonable at the beginning of it, right, at its inception. So there's a margin for error. Okay. All right. And again, just because the arrestee is ultimately released or acquitted does not mean that the arrest is illegal. Now, Walt has, I feel strongly that probable cause decisions differ from reasonable suspicion decisions based on one word, and it is specificity. A crime versus a criminal activity afoot. You don't have to be right, you have to be reasonable. Yep, that's actually true. We're actually going to talk about that. So that's pretty good, Walt. All right. The officers, okay, let's talk about this good faith stuff, okay? The officers in good faith believed Miller was Hill and arrested him. So they arrested the wrong guy. They were quite wrong, as it turned out. And subjective good faith would not in itself justify either the arrest or the subsequent search. Did you hear me? Was I super clear in this because, or the Supreme Court super clear in this because this is something that happens all the time. Good faith is not a justification for a warrantless arrest, a warrantless search. It's not what you feel in your heart. It's what you can articulate. But on the record before us, the officer's mistake was understandable and the arrest a reasonable response to the situation facing at the time. Okay. This is a very, very common thing that I hear throughout law enforcement. They think that, hey, if I make a mistake, as long as my heart is in the right place, as long as I can put one hand over the heart and the other one on the Bible, if I'm being sued, I'm gonna be okay. No, you will not. Okay. You cannot go to court and justify your warrantless searches and seizures on your heart, on what you think is going on. You have to be objective. And we're going to talk about those mistakes of fact. This is a very common thing where officers think one thing. They thought that this was a fact in the case, but actually it turned out wrong, right? Listen to what the Williams court said. They said an officer's reasonable, the word is always reasonable, right? That's what the Fourth Amendment says. An officer's reasonable mistake of fact can provide probable cause for a stop because the officer's belief that the seatbelt was unbuckled was reasonable. Whether or not it was erroneous, he had the probable cause necessary to conduct the stop. So, mistake of fact, these are things that you end up, like the witness says the car was red, it was actually brown. You thought the seatbelt was on, but off, it was actually on. You thought that the registered owner was the one driving the car, he's the one who had the warrant. Turns out that it's his twin brother driving the car. Trust me, I know, okay? As a twin. If an officer is mistaken about a relevant fact, that mistaken belief may still be counted favorably towards probable cause, as long as the mistake was reasonable. Okay. And it happens all the time. The suspect was described as a white male adult. However, it was a light-skinned Hispanic male adult, right? And the defendant will try to get out of those charges by saying, well, it was a mistake of fact and so forth. These are just reasonable issues. The another one that I saw a case on was the citizen said that it was a BMW. The suspect, the robbery suspects and so forth was in a BMW. The cops saw a Mercedes that was similar, right? Place, time, location, Mercedes, black Mercedes, not a black BMW. Stopped the vehicle, boom. The vehicle was the right vehicle, right? And so the cop realized that the citizen had a mistake of fact. The point is, we just use common sense. And Hine is our, now this is kind of a weird video. We're trying to make more of these videos. It's harder than you think with AI, but at the end of the day, what happened in Hine is that it was a stop for a tail light, a brake light that was out. However, this was not actually a violation of North Carolina law, North Kakalaki statutes. They wrote the statute with the Model T in mind, right? The Model T had one brake light on the left, I believe, and did not make them with two, right? The Model T kind of an example. Well, the officer was like, I don't know about any Model Ts, but I think all these cars need two brake lights. And so he no, Brooks, you're good. And so he stopped the vehicle and and end up being finding evidence of another crime in there. And the question here is whether reasonable suspicion or probable cause can rest on mistaken understanding of the scope of a legal prohibition. We hold that it can. So now you have to be reasonable here, right? It's almost like the law was written so crappy that why should we penalize the cop? You guys with me on this? Like the law was written so convoluted that why should we penalize this police officer? And many police officers in America only have a high school diploma, right? I mean, many have college degrees, but many still have high school diplomas. Why should we be like, hey, you're not even a legal, you don't have an extensive amount of education, and you're like, you're penalizing this guy. I'm not saying that education is really a factor, but the reality is that these are not—they're not lawyers. They're not lawyers, so it's reasonable. As the court said, the government cannot defend an officer's mistaken legal interpretation on the ground that the officer was unaware of or untrained in a law. So even though I got to be careful how I describe this, even though a cop with a high school education versus the cop with a master's degree, they're both presumed to understand the law. And it means that an officer's reliance on incorrect memo or training program from the police department makes no difference in analysis. So do you think there are trainers out there? And I'm not saying I'm not perfect, okay? I'm not perfect, but I try to be, as accurate as I can. But do you think there are trainers out there or training programs out there that are teaching cops things that are not legit, right? That are a misinterpretation of the law? Absolutely. I mean, I got officer, I got a there's an instructor out there that says that we can automatically hold people for canine sniffs for up to 2 hours. Not even really basing it off anything particular. Like we have like it's almost like they have a 2 hour rule. Ridiculous. Do we have instructors, FTOs that do this? Absolutely. Children raising children, right? It's not their fault. They have training scars. They're just teaching what they were taught. And so you got to be careful about this. We run into these training scars all the time at Blue to Gold. And they just like, hey, this is what I was taught. If somebody is going to be trespassed, even though they weren't given the opportunity to leave, we can still detain them and demand their ID. Where'd you get that from? Right? I got it from my FTO when I started. It is likely, now I will tell you, okay, mistake of fact and mistake of law are two different standards. It will be rare, okay? Rare, like bloody steak, rare, that a court will find that an officer had a reasonable mistake of law. It's common they'll have a mistake of fact, but listen to me carefully. Mistake of law is absolutely rare. Let me give you an example in Nevada, okay? In Nevada, there's a signal, right? You have to use your signal to make a to change lanes. Well, come to find out that that law is not enforceable unless it affects another person's driving. So all these years that I was a trooper in Nevada, I thought that if I saw them, a quarter mile down the highway and they're all alone in that lonely highway at 1 o'clock in the morning and they change lanes without a signal, I would stop them because I thought they had to use a signal. Now, I'm not telling you I'm trying to be nitpicky here, but I'm looking for DUIs and so forth. And I would stop them and, we just go from there. I was wrong. I was wrong. The Nevada Supreme Court has held recently in the last 2 years or so that that is not a viable reading. That's not an accurate reading of the law, that it actually requires other people to be affected by that turning movement. That is the argument of reasonable mistake of law. And maybe I was reasonable, maybe I wasn't. So you do have an obligation to be, you have an obligation to know the law, okay? You can say that ignorance of the law is no excuse. Maybe that's one way of looking at it, right? But the better way is saying that you have to be, you have to, you are held to a very high standard to understand what the law is. But if it's a reasonable misinterpretation, like even the judges were confused by it, then you should get a pass. And Mike says you really have to know your laws. That's absolutely true. Actually, Evan, your comment did not go to anybody. By the way, just so we're on the topic, and maybe I can sell you on something, bring us out. But do you know that there was a case out there where the agency, an agency in Washington, they required their officers to self-study on the law, right? Constitutional law and like search and seizure stuff and like keep abreast of the legal changes. So they required, they basically left it up to their officers to self-study. One of their officers got it wrong and they got sued. Did you know that the court found that the agency was liable for deliberate indifference because they should have known that self-study is not an adequate training regimen for legal updates? So if you're an agency that does not have professional in-service formalized, training for legal issues like search and seizure, that you can be held liable for those mistakes. You can't just pass the buck onto your police officers. So that's why I am here. I'm trying to help you. I'm trying to help you. So even if, you're a chief of police, you can, if, as long as you, hey, go to Anthony's webinars. Do you know that actually that will help you in a lawsuit for deliberate indifference? I'm just telling you that. So that's actually the case. I'll tell you the case. It's out of Washington. Let me, Tom, I will get that case for you at the end of the webinar because I got to pull up my database. Okay. I don't know the name off the top of my head, but I'll get you that case, my friend. But remind me, remind me. Is probable cause standard subjective or objective? Is probable cause standard objective or subjective? Okay. It's good faith on the part of the arresting officer is not enough. I already told you what's in your heart is not enough. If subjective good faith alone were the test, the protections of the Fourth Amendment would evaporate and the people would be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects only in the discretion of the police. Why? Because they would always say they were what? Reasonable. Every cop I have met that have made a mistake that they were later found to have violated somebody's rights, every single one has always told me, Anthony, when I did it, I thought I was doing the right thing. Okay. Whether probable cause exists is an objective question of law. Okay. Here the policeman testified that he did not have probable cause to search. Oh, snap. You guys with me on this? He is saying, I don't have probable cause, Your Honor. I was wrong. I don't have probable cause. I thought maybe I thought it did, but I'm looking at it. I did not have probable cause. And at best was merely suspicious. Of course, we would not consider ourselves bound by a police officer's inability to articulate his conclusions if the facts clearly demonstrated the existence of probable cause. So this is even the court saying, hey, even if the cop thinks he was wrong, if the court thinks he was right, then we're going to win. In fact, there's a Supreme Court, a Fifth Circuit case out there called U.S. v. Richmond that talks about that. Now, since the existence of probable cause is objective, it's ultimately the decision of the court, the judge, to determine whether or not probable cause existed. You make the call, you call the ball, and the judge will double check your work. Let's do a commercial break. Real quick, I want to tell you about other things that we do. By the way, Rick and his team made this cute little cartoon last week, this week maybe. And I'm telling you, I am so impressed with what they're doing. We have a great graphic artist team. This is a flashback to the old intermission cartoons of the, the movies and so forth. So, so guys, here's a brand new service that we offer. We offer a service called Legal Roll Call, right? So now what we have is a formalized program where we can actually teach you. The videos, they drip twice a week, and these are legit, structured, tested videos by lawyers that just give you like 5 to 10 minutes of a search and seizure provision, or Fifth Amendment. Every week, and that and they're trackable, so you know who watched and who didn't. So guys, if you want to keep out of trouble and you want to also build confidence, you really need to check out our Legal Roll Call. Rick will put a link in the chat, and you can actually sign up for Legal Roll Call for free to check it out. Okay, but it is a legit service. People that signed up for it love it. It's not that expensive. It is a very good product that we have, and Legal Roll Call is legit. Training and experience. So, in determining, I appreciate that, guys. In determining whether the officer acted reasonably in such circumstances, due weight must be given to the specific specific reasonable inferences which he is entitled to draw in light of what? Your experience. So the more experience, the more likely you are able to articulate something that is awry, right? Something that is reasonable suspicion. What constitutes probable cause for searches and seizures must be determined from the standpoint of the officer with his skill and knowledge, rather from who? An average citizen that gets their legal knowledge from NCIS Hawaii, okay? Do not believe it. These people who watch NCIS Hawaii, they think they know more than you about criminal activity, but they don't, okay? Okay, mom, you listening here, okay? No more NCIS Hawaii. That stuff is ruining your brain. The probable cause determination must ultimately be made by a judicial officer who is not an expert in matters of law enforcement. We got to recognize that these judges are K through JD. They went to kindergarten through JD, through law school, became a lawyer, became a judge, and it's incumbent on the officer to explain the nature of his expertise. What is the most important word, the most powerful word in a police report? What is that most powerful word? And it's the word because. Thank you, Amanda, Daniel, right? It's the word because. You need to explain why you have probable cause, okay? Even lawyers struggle with because, okay? You need to say, I conducted a pat down. I had reasonable suspicion. I had probable cause with because. Do not give conclusory statements. Never, ever, ever tell a lawyer, prosecutor, judge, jury how to think. You tell them why to think. You guys with me on this? Not how, but why. That's how you win cases. That's how you send people to prison. That's how you forfeit their cars that they bought with drug money. Because you say because and you describe what you mean. You are the smart. Just remember something. And I mean this, okay? Yeah, I'm not trying to embellish this. When you walk into that courtroom, you are absolutely the smartest person in that room for that case. Nobody, not the prosecutor, not the defense attorney, not the defense, the defendant, not the judge, not the jury, knows more about that case than you. And you need to show it off with this mentality of the word because. Okay. Now, the quantum of evidence needed for a search or a seizure is the same. It's just that fair probability. Now, we're not going to. Okay. So, Walt. Let's see. Walt says, is the because in a police report typically a trial issue or a suppression issue? It's a suppression issue. Oftentimes, a suppression issue. And really, all things are handled with the report. I mean, most, I don't know, Walt, you've been to my report writing class, but most of these suppression issues are handled at the report level. It also, the deal with the trial is like, I have an instructor for me, Jessica Wall. She is she's a badass, okay? She's a badass prosecutor in Vegas. She teaches for Blue to Gold. And she says the most powerful word in a police report is the word because. The most dangerous word in a trial during testifying is the word because. You guys with me on this? The most powerful word in a police report is the word because. The most dangerous word during testimony in a trial is the word because. The reason I say this is because officers want to elaborate on things that they were not asked. But the point is, the word because handles a lot of the trial issues. They plea out. They plea out. Now, really, I appreciate Jenny. Jenny, she is great. She's a baller. She's very, very smart. Very smart. Quite frankly, the smartest prosecutor I've ever met. So reasonable suspicion is a form of probable cause, right? It's like probable cause light. It's just that everything is easier. The information is easier. The quantum of proof is less. The reliability is less. Right? I just went blank on this guy. Rick, what's this guy's name? Oh my God! Why did I go blank? I know Mini Me is his partner, but Mr. Evil, Dr. Evil, Jesus. So. It's like Dr. Evil, and then it's like Mini Me, right? Mini Me is reasonable suspicion, and Dr. Evil is at least probable cause. Okay, so why reasonable suspicion? It's again lesser information, less specificity, which Walt talked about. Okay, the factual justification continuum or burdens of proof, right? Let's skip that actually. So here is burdens of proof. You have hunches, right? Now, hunches cannot be used to search or seize, but do you think that they are nevertheless valuable? Do they help with investigations? Absolutely, right? They help with pointing you in the right direction. They help with encouraging you to make a consensual encounter because a lot of times you can ferret out crime with that consensual encounter. Reasonable suspicion is a moderate chance of illegal activity. We talked about that last week. And for those who are watching this webinar on demand, if you reach out to us soon enough, quick enough, on our website through the chat function, we will give you a link to that webinar. But it does expire within 30 days. So you only have probably a couple weeks from the time of this broadcast. So if anybody out there, Rick, you already put that link in there once, right? So for those who are watching, if you want to watch the reasonable suspicion deep dive, you need to reach out to us ASAP. Otherwise, you're going to have to wait till the next webinar. Probable cause, that's what we're talking about today. Preponderance of the evidence. That is the only burden of proof that we actually have a number for, right? We know it's 51%, right? 50 plus one. Clear and convincing evidence. That is a burden of proof that most cops have not heard of. But clear and convincing evidence is a burden of proof that is like, I like to say probable cause, reasonable suspicion is probable cause light. Clear and convincing is probable cause plus, right? It's probable cause on steroids. And that's a burden of proof that some courts will use for your Miranda waivers. They'll use that for your consent searches. They want to see clear and convincing evidence that the person agreed to a consent search. But you have to talk to your prosecutor. I cannot tell you what your state does because it's, Texas is clear and convincing. I do know that. Beyond a reasonable doubt, that's the burden of proof you need to convict, right? And absolute certainty. You don't need absolute certainty, but it's sometimes nice to have it. Okay. So now what, to go to Rick, to get the PowerPoint, you got to go to the store, okay? And then download that, please. Rick can't send it to you. That's not okay. Just go to the store. Okay. Rick, it seems like he's getting it. So, okay, cool. Factual justification, like 0% is absolute no certainty. 100% is I absolutely know it. Beyond reasonable doubt, absolute certainty, close to 100%. Clear and convincing evidence, 70%. Preponderance of the evidence, 51%. Probable cause, less than 50%. Did you hear me? Probable cause, as a U.S. Supreme Court, is less than preponderance of the evidence. It doesn't have to be more likely than not, even though a lot of cops are taught that in the academy. And I got to tell you, if you're on this academy, I'm sorry, if you're on this webinar and you're teaching the academy, and you're saying, hey, recruits, probable cause is more likely than not. It's like, eh, like that. We're still friends because you know what? I think that actually helps recruits because they're already kind of, their brain is really already mush. And why not give them something kind of concrete? But once they get out of FTO and we do in-service training, maybe start telling them, hey, your academy instructor lied to you. It's a little more complicated than that, but we had to do it to you for your own good. Reasonable suspicion is between like 30 to 25, 30% ish, 40%. And then you have hunches, which is closer to zero. Okay. So probable cause requires more than bare suspicion, but less than preponderance of the evidence. Okay. All right. Now, at the lowest level, probable cause does not have to be more likely than not. But in other cases, probable cause may be, more likely than not, especially with your minor cases. I'll give you some examples, but here's an example. Okay. Three men commit an armed robbery, which resulted in the shooting death of the victim. Only one of the robbers has played and used a handgun. So we have a GSR issue, a gunshot residue issue. The police obtained a search warrant to search each one of their residences for the one firearm. And also, I want their hands. Let's just say that we got them in custody, okay? I also want to search their hands. I want to search their houses. And I want to search their hands for the GSR. There is less than 50% probability that the gun is in any one of his particular residences. It's less than 50% that the GSR is on their hands. Are we going to get that warrant? Will a judge give us that warrant? Yes or no? You know they will. Absolutely. The warrant will be issued. Okay. Standing outside a vehicle, a police officer observed several white pills inside the vehicle. Without closer examination, it's impossible to tell the visual observational by visual observation alone whether the pills are illegal drugs or aspirin or other lawful to possess substance. At best, is equivocal whether the pills are illegal. They just seem kind of suspicious. Is this probable cause of search? The answer is no, right? You don't have probable cause. You don't have a fair probability that those pills are illegal. Do you have reasonable suspicion? Maybe, probably. Let's do another quick commercial break. Guys, my advanced search and seizure class, pills in the Altima, yeah, or the 300. So my reasonable suspicion class is off the, I'm sorry, advanced search and seizure class is off the hook. I have all my training is recorded in a professional studio and so forth. And it's the same training you get live, except I'm much funnier in person, but less good looking. See, this kind of works. I'm funnier, but maybe that's why I'm funnier, because I'm less good looking. But the point is that all my training is on demand. Again, this is another way to continue knowledge. Tell your agency to buy this for you, okay? Also, this class is only $143. Normally, right now, it's on sale. Normally, this class is $240 in person. So you're getting this thing for cheap. And it includes the search and seizure book. There's no way that you should not be doing this. So, yep, that is off the hook. That is off the hook. So same class, 8-hour lesson plan. Get the book, $143. If you want the link, Rick will send it to you. These QR codes can be tough, especially if you're watching your phone. But this is your chance to learn. You will love that class. That is my my flagship class. We're over 8 million. Look, I'll do it for 4. Okay, source information. That's awesome, Justin. Source information. So there is federal and state rules regarding evidence, but here's the deal. Do we care about the rules of evidence when it comes to probable cause? Yes or no, right? Do we care about hearsay and authentication? No, right? You guys are not attorneys, right? And some of you guys are attorneys, and some of you guys are attorney cops, right? Like John Wayne and so forth was, right? Before I snagged him and stole him for blue to gold. You know, Chris McFarlane, another one of my instructors, lawyer. Right before becoming an instructor for Little Gold. But most of you are not. So what about these polygraphs? And what about, you know, again, here's the information. So as a matter of federal law, polygraph results are one of the many factors which may be used in determining whether, from an objective viewpoint, probable cause for an arrest existed under the Fourth Amendment. But usually, is a polygraph used in a criminal case? Absolutely not. We don't use that voodoo techniques. I mean, why don't you just get out a Ouija board? You know what I'm saying? That's about as accurate as a polygraph machine. And if you're a polygrapher, and when I first heard that word, I didn't think it was a compliment. So if you are a polygrapher and you do polygraphs for a living, I'm sorry, but I'm not trying to insult your profession here, but I'm not sure it's a lie detector machine, right? And you know, it's, you know, that's not what it is. But the point is, it's a little suspect in some situations, but you know, you don't have to have, you know, reliable, you don't have to, you know, just because it can't be admitted against a criminal trial does not mean that you can't use it as probable cause. A good example of this case was Stanberry. Here's what happened. In a nutshell, a lady, an older black female entered a I don't, it doesn't really matter what the store is, but it's like not like a Sears, but like a department store. But she entered, she tried to, steal some stuff, and she had some old Navy bags that she was trying to put, put the stuff in. And the cops went to the old Navy that was close by to, like, they showed her, they had the videotape of this alleged, shoplifter. And they showed her a video of this person, and all the people, they said, oh yeah, I know who she is. She was just in here like an hour ago, and she tried to purchase some old Navy clothes, and her credit card declined. And we also found some old Navy bags, right, from the back of the warehouse area, strewn across some of the aisles. So it seemed to me like she was in here. It looks like that was her. Her credit card declined, so maybe she doesn't have any money. And she also, I think, stole, maybe she was the one that stole some bags, and that's why these bags were like on the ground. And then an hour later, allegedly she that same person goes to that department store and uses the old Navy bags to, like, stuff clothes. Well, the problem with this case was they only showed one picture of the suspect, like this her DMV photo. They only showed one picture to the old Navy people, right? And they're like, yeah, that's her. And it actually violated their policy, because they're not supposed to do show ups, infield show ups, photo arrays like this. They're supposed to do a six pack and find four like people, right? Similar looking people. And at the end of the day, she got arrested. I guess she was not the person. The charges were dropped against her, and she sued. And she said, she said, hey, this ID procedure was flawed. This other stuff, you could have done a better job with the investigation and so forth. But can I ask you something? I hate innocent people getting arrested. I would not want to get arrested for a crime I did not commit. But at the end of the day, did the police have probable cause that she actually did commit the crime? With all these witnesses saying that, yeah, she was the one in here, and the connection with the old Navy bags and so forth. And the answer is yes, right? So the court said, we conclude that the identification procedures employed here, although highly improper because they kind of violated good practice, were not so flawed that they could not contribute to the finding of probable cause. And Walt says, once probable cause is shown, both false arrest and malicious prosecution claims should be failed. Yes, not only that, Walt, it's actually the standard is not probable cause for civil rights violations. It's arguable probable cause. It's even a less standard, meaning if there is a reasonable officer out there that could have found probable cause, then it's even more likely you will not be found liable. But we cannot ignore the truth. So if later during the investigation we find evidence that the person is innocent, then we have to, release the person. Tell the prosecutor that we got the wrong guy and so forth. What about PBTs, right? PBTs, preliminary breath test. That is a very common thing that we do during DUI investigation. A PBT lacks sufficient reliability to be admitted as substantive evidence. It's not Dauber, right? Dauber is your scientific, doctrine about how you admit scientific evidence. It doesn't pass Dauber, but it is still admissible in court. What about criminal history, right? Absolutely. Now, you know that most criminal history cannot be used in a criminal trial. Why? Because we do not want the jury thinking once a criminal, always a criminal. However, can you use criminal history in your probable cause assessment? Absolutely, right? A person's criminal history is among the circumstances a judge may consider when determining whether probable cause exists. What about Miranda warnings? What if we get it wrong? What if we don't read Miranda? What if we, whoops, do we lose everything? No, because Miranda is a little more complicated. It's not a constitutional right. We know that now. We didn't know that back in 1967. The Supreme Court kind of fooled us a little bit. They kind of hoodwinked us. But as the courts have said, statements taken in violation of Miranda may not be used to prove a prosecution's chief in trial, right? But such evidence may be used. So evidence from the Miranda violation. Like, so for example, we ask them, hey, like during, let's say we didn't think they were in custody, but they were actually in custody and we were interrogating them. You're like, hey, where'd you hide that gun? Oh man, I put it in my attic. It's under a pillow in the attic. And like, you sleep in the attic? No, this is my pillow's up there. Just, and, I put it up there. It's right at the pillow. And the cops get a warrant and they find the gun at the pillow. That gun is coming in. Right? Here comes this. Why are you jealous of me, Mike? You know why? First of all, the only accent I can do is a Southern accent because my heart is in Texas. Okay. My house is in Idaho, but my heart is in Texas. Don't get jealous. A Miranda violation will not cause an otherwise voluntary statement to be excluded. Okay. So, hearsay. What is hearsay? Hearsay is gossip. Hearsay is, hey, somebody told me this. You cannot introduce gossip out of court statements into court to prove a matter asserted, to prove the person is guilty, and or to prove something that happened, right? So, what about this case right here where this guy said, hey, this tipster said, hey, this person's coming in to the train station. He's going to be wearing this coat, wearing the brown paper bag. He has this particular gait. This is the way he walks. The cop sees it and then stops him, searches his bag, and we go from there, right? So, so petitioner contends that the information given by the informer to the officer was hearsay. And because hearsay is not legally competent evidence in a criminal trial, could not be legally have been considered in court. No, that's not the rules. You guys do not work under rules of evidence. You work with just common sense interpretations of the facts. Okay, so hearsay can come in. Now, as with any other type of evidence, you got to prove the person is reliable. How do you prove the person is reliable? Okay. Number one is explain why he's reliable. You need to explain to the court, why should I trust this person? Why should I give this person the time of day? And number two, how do they know what they know? If I were you, first of all, I have a class, and I don't know if Rick, if this is scheduled again, but I have a webinar on anonymous tips. And if you want to really know how to prove tipsters, whether anonymous or unanonymous, right? Is that the right word? Then you need to watch my webinar, Anonymous Tips. I break it down step by step. Okay. Mike, answer that question. You might want to ask that question on the webinar. I might need some context there. Okay. So I just told you what the reliable source credibility. Other police officers is good to go, right? If another police officer tells you something, you're good. Citizen informers. The law presumes that, and happy birthday, Mike. I'm glad I got you something. So the law presumes that citizen informers are legit, that they are giving you accurate information. Okay, a citizen informer is presumed to speak honestly and accurately. Why? They have no axe to grind. They're not getting anything out of it. The criminal snitches get stitches, who is making a quid pro quo trade enjoys no such presumption because they want that money. They want that release of charges. They have an axe to grind. What about confidential informers? Confidential informers, you've got to be careful with, right? Again, you've got to establish a track record, credibility, prior contacts, et cetera, et cetera. Usually because they helped you help get convictions. They helped you get arrests. They discovered contraband and so forth. All right. That is about it.